Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 project here on the Nerd Party, the only podcast that takes you through the back catalogue of A24 films, two films at a time every fortnight, plus exclusive interviews with the people behind the films. I'm your co-host Dallas King, and with me as always is Lee Hutchison. How are you this week?
Yo, I'm good, thanks.
Yo, was that you attempting to be like you were from New York or something?
Yes, I'm trying to do my best to channel a British accent through kind of Brooklyn voice. So as my best sort of RPATS kind of thing that I can do.
Okay, well, we're joined in the pod booth this week by A24 Stan and writer for Outtake magazine, Laura Portier. Welcome to the A24 project, and you can be the judge. What did you think of Lee's Brooklyn accent there?
I thought it was pretty poor, I won't lie.
Yo!
That was slightly better.
Was it?
Only ever so slightly, but you do have to be nice to him. Remember, if you want to get invited back on the Ladybird episode, he's already been threatening you, I saw, on Instagram and Facebook chat. So you've got to be nice to him.
Yeah, I do get bullied on there.
So before we deep dive into our featured titles this week, Laura, I just want to get you to sort of introduce yourself and sort of tell listeners about how you discovered A24 films and perhaps maybe sort of tell us what sort of some of your favourite titles are, minus anything that we're going to discuss in this episode, of course.
Yeah. Do you know, I think the first ever A24 title I watched was Lady Bird, maybe, I think. It's definitely the most memorable one and one of my favourites. And Ex Machina as well, obviously. I love that film, and anyone who knows me knows that. So yeah, top two.
Okay, excellent. So what we're going to do is sort of dive into some quick A24-hour news. And full disclaimer, we're recording this at the end of September, prior to the London Film Festival, which we're all going to be at. And we're originally going to give you the news a miss, but because we are normally cursed to be out of date and behind the times, recording a few days in advance, let alone a month. But today, something dropped online that made it perfect for discussion on today's episode. And that was the first trailer for the Safdie brothers' Uncut Gems. They're the filmmakers behind Good Time, which we're going to discuss in a little bit. But this is the film starring Adam Sandler as a jewel salesman who has, as very similar to Good Time, a day from hell. So have you guys watched this one? What did you make of it? Lee, let's come to you first.
Yeah, this one, I have to try and stay on top of the news. I have like Twitter notifications and Instagram notifications set for whenever A24 tweet any content. Sometimes it's to be able to pick up some merchandise before it sells out, and other times it usually you're getting like, hey, these critics like this thing. And then sort of the middle of the afternoon here in the UK, it went new tweet from A24, and they'd much hype that this was going to be the day the Uncut Gems trailer dropped. So the first time I watched this trailer was on a mobile device at my office desk, and I really enjoyed it. This has been one I've been really looking forward to, and I know some people are kind of like still cracking the jokes of like, hey, it's Adam Sandler, what's he like starring in a serious film? But this is a guy that's showing that he's done some great performances with Paul Thomas Anderson, Noah Baumbach, and the Meyerowitz stories. So as soon as I heard that the Safdie brothers had added them to the cast, there was no doubt that it was going to be another hit for me. And I think this trailer has me very excited. It seems like absolutely right up my street. And no one does sort of condensed time quite like the Safdie brothers. So I'm interested to see what this other day in the life story is going to be like. I think it's going to be pretty nuts. And I'm really, really hoping it's going to be the surprise film at the London Film Festival.
Absolutely, because yeah, as mentioned, this podcast is recorded in advance, so there's a chance that by the time you're listening to this, we may have already watched it if it is indeed the surprise film, and we can bring you a teaser review if that happens in the future. But Laura, have you managed to catch the trailer yet? What did you think of it?
Yeah, so I saw it as I was coming out of another screening, so I was like, same as Lee, had to watch it on my mobile. And to be honest, I wasn't all that excited for it until I saw the trailer, because I'm definitely not an Adam Sandler fan, and I'm definitely one of those people who was absolutely judging when he was cast in this film. But I have to admit that the trailer looks really good and I'm excited to see it.
Yeah, no, I was one that didn't really know much about the film, I've sort of like to sort of keep away from sort of any sort of thing that might spoil my sort of anticipation of the film in terms of finding out what the film's about. But I did watch the trailer because, you know, it's my job giving the news report today. But I thought it was a really well cut trailer that sort of hypes up the frenetic energy of this day of this guy who's seemingly losing money all over town, and there's potential links to a basketball game or something. But I think and then I was like, ooh, Idina Menzel's in this, so I wonder if they're going to get to sing or if they're going to have another missed opportunity like Enchanted, where they basically wasted her on that. But it's still a good film. But I'm excited to see this one, and yeah, no, it's exciting to see Adam Sandler return to a dramatic role, because despite all the easy jokes to make, he when he does turn it on, he can be a very effective actor. So very looking forward to this one. Perhaps it will be a gem of a movie. Oh, and I'm sure many
nice
other people
one.
Will make that. Thank you. Yeah, you can stay. You can stay on the podcast. So there's only one other sort of tidbit of news that's sort of come up in the last few days, days and speaking as in up to the days of recording, and that is A24 favourite, if you listen to our 20th Century Woman episode, writer-director Mike Mills is going to be making an untitled and undescribed A24 film with Joaquin Phoenix. Does this excite people? Laura, would you be excited to see these two team up?
Yeah, very much so. Great director and great actor who's really having a moment right now, so might be a good time to cast him in something if you want to get attention.
Absolutely. Is this going to be up there for your most anticipated of whichever year it eventually comes out?
Oh, definitely. I remember me and you chatting a few weeks ago that Mike Mills, he sort of picks his moments to kind of make films, and obviously 20th Century Women is a favourite of mine for a few years, and it's a new favourite of yourself. So feeling that this sort of came hot off the back of our conversation had me even more excited, and I'm curious to definitely see Joaquin Phoenix in the Joker film. But he's been producing such great films for so long, and he's again someone else that seems to pick his films really well, so again his involvement has me excited. I mean, we don't even know what the hell this film's going to be about, but I'm immediately excited by seeing this pairings, and hopefully this follow-up to 20th Century Women is as exciting as I hope.
Absolutely. Joaquin Phoenix, you know, a fantastic actor, but from what I read recently, maybe not the best interviewee. So we shall move on to talk about our first film of the episode, and first up for discussion is Menashe, and this is a film about the titular character of Menashe, who is a widower struggling to find his place within Brooklyn's ultra-Orthodox Jewish community as he tries to win custody back of his son and explores the nature of faith and fatherhood. This is directed and co-written by Joshua Weinstein, and also co-written and produced by Alex Lipschultz. It was nominated for Best Feature at the International Spirit Awards and also Best International Feature at the Edinburgh Film Festival. And we can actually hear now from Alex because Lee was lucky enough to talk to him at the festival in 2017. So let's hear what he had to say about the making of the film.
I mean, even until just prior to Sundance, like a few weeks before they announced, we still didn't know what we were going to call it, and because we just couldn't agree on the title. And uh-huh. We were just finally like, fuck it, just call it Menashe. Nobody will be able to pronounce it, uh-huh. But we can't think of anything better.
I suppose that kind of opens up like one of the questions I was thinking, that like you must be really proud. I think this was A24's first foreign language feature.
Yeah.
How difficult was it going in, because obviously you're a producer as well as a writer, of thinking, right, we're going to do this in kind of a language that's not been really represented in cinema? Do you worry from a production point of view that, oh, this is going to maybe limit our scope or our audience? And you think,
sure,
maybe if we just do it in English, this will get the audience it.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've had this experience in a few different movies where there's like some critical component to it that on the face of it seems like a terrible idea from a market perspective. There was making this film in Yiddish, and then the first feature I produced was a movie called Computer Chess, and we shot that on 40-year-old black and white analog video cameras. So it's black and white, it's kind of fuzzy, you know, it's a far cry from modern HD. And with both of those movies, a lot of people were like, don't do that. That is just going to cripple you. But honestly, my feeling ahead of each film, and then now that each one has kind of, you know, that one was released years ago, and Menashe has now played a bunch of festivals and been acquired for distribution, so we kind of know where it's going. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll crap out in theaters, but I think, honestly, those things that seem like they would make it terribly niche actually make the thing stand out a lot more as being unique. you know, rather than having a single language movie, we can say it's like, okay, it's just one of the first films that's entirely in Yiddish in 50, 60, 70 years. And I think the bottom line is that when you're making a film about this community with no stars, so on and so forth, it's like the ceiling for the kind of audience you're going to find and the kind of business you're going to do is only so high. So maybe you're lowering it a bit by deciding to make the whole thing in Yiddish, but I actually think that it made a stronger case for the creative elements of the film, and I think connected better with audiences and feels more specific by virtue of that.
Yeah.
So weirdly, I think it's actually made the movie more marketable in its own strange way.
When I was watching it, I thought it was like, it's the perfect representation of what a film festival movie should be about, that it's about a community or a story where you don't know anything about that, and by watching it, you get to learn about something totally new. And I never knew about kind of the religious aspect, where if you're widowed, the child has to go live with another. It was just, it was mind-blowing. What was it like kind of from a writing point of view to write this story, that to make sure that it was as authentic as possible? And I noticed that the actor, Menasha Lustig, like a lot of the story was actually based on his life. How much did that play a role in the writing process, and how did it all kind of come together?
It's interesting, you know, so the genesis of the movie was Josh Weinstein, the co-writer and director. I think he knew he wanted to make a film set in the Hasidic community in Brooklyn. He comes from a documentary background, so I think initially he thought, like, okay, I'll make a doc about that world. And so he went out into that world the way he's done, having made prior docs, and just tried to meet people. And he randomly met Menasha through a few other Hasids he knew. And in talking to Menasha and learning about his backstory, it was like, oh, this guy has a fascinating life story. But you couldn't really make a documentary about it, because everything has already sort of happened, and 99% of the people in his life would never, ever, ever be willing to be on camera. So I think at that point he kind of pivoted and was like, maybe there is a way to tell some kind of version of this story through the mechanics of narrative fiction, and having Menasha playing a version of himself and finding other people in the community to play versions of the various people in Menasha's life. So once he kind of made that decision, that was when he and I started talking about it. And I think in writing it, and we wrote it with another writer, a Muslim guy named Musa Saeed, actually, who's a writer-director in his own right in the States. You know, we had a number of conversations with Menasha about his life and his struggles and what had happened, but less than you would think. You know, like, it's, the movie is not sort of like beat for beat his autobiography. It's really taking, like, the loose structure and points of who he is as a man, what his personality is like, what his kind of, maybe some of his personal failings have or haven't been, or how they've been seen by various members of the community, and building something that felt like an interesting filmic narrative out of that. And we were kind of writing this thing as we went. We started shooting it from a treatment, actually, and shot the thing in pieces over the course of about a year and a half. And over that time, through additional writing and rewriting and improvisations and reshooting and everything, you know, cobbled something that feels, I think, like an organic narrative out of it. But a lot of it, you know, a lot of the finer points of the specifics of this culture, we didn't really gather from reading a ton of books or anything or academic materials. It was really just from talking with Menasha and talking with other Hasids and spending time in that world and just kind of trying to understand their life from the inside out, rather than from more kind of academic or ethnographic perspective of outside in.
And how difficult was it kind of from a production point of view that this is a community that can be often against, say, like the television, social media, to go in there with film cameras and to even cast actors? How difficult a challenge was that, especially over a long period of time, and to get a consistency and kind of, for say, from their beards as well?
Yeah, it was hugely challenging. You know, I've produced work with non-professional actors before, and I've also produced work with movie stars before, and there's already a bit of a difference there. And when you're building a film that's meant to be with non-professionals, casting it is really what's going to make or break that movie. And it ends up being a situation where you just end up looking at a million people and trying to understand them and how they seem in person, how they're going to read on camera, if once you've got lights and a crew around, if they're just going to freeze up or not. But the nice thing is you've kind of got endless options. With this, the thing that made it so much trickier, because almost none of the cast has ever acted before in their lives, and most of them have never even seen movies before in their lives, the tricky thing is that 95% of the people that we approach in the Hasidic world to see if they would even want to audition for a movie like this, we're just like, no way.
Mm-hmm.
No interest, not going to happen. So our options for who we could cast in the film were limited. And the way we kind of worked around that was when we found people who seemed interesting, looked interesting, and had kind of very specific, interesting personalities, we sort of re-engineered the roles to those people specifically. Not necessarily to, like, the biographical details of their lives, like the guy who plays the Ruv, the rabbi. He's not a rabbi. He's a cab driver, actually.
Okay, right.
But he had, interestingly enough, he had trained, he'd gone to yeshiva and trained to be a rabbi, so he had that background already. And I think somehow, once he started playing this role, it was like all that old rabbinical training. He kind of, he actually became quite bossy.
Yeah.
Once he was like, no, well, the rabbi says this. It's like, but you're not actually a rabbi.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was sort of one of the tricks of it, was really just re-engineering these roles and building them from the ground up for the specific people that we found who were open to being in a movie and who, with some screen tests, we felt like could perform naturally.
And have you had much feedback from that community, or is it something you're ultimately accepting? Kind of much of this film is about that community, and they might not be able to see this movie.
I mean, a huge part of the community will never watch this movie, and I'm sure that there are portions of it. I know for a fact, actually, there are portions of it that have been made aware of it just through word of mouth, and they're not happy that it exists. But interestingly enough, I think that there has been a lot of interest and excitement from that community, and the folks that have seen it, you know, it hasn't been released in the States yet theatrically, it's just played festivals, so it hasn't been available to the general public in any kind of long-standing form. It will be in a few weeks. But interestingly, we've been getting really good feedback from members of the Orthodox community. I think they feel like it captures their lives really authentically and that it's fairly even-handed in terms of how it approaches them. I think the concern for a lot of them was that, you know, these sort of secular Jewish filmmakers were going to come in there and make something that was particularly damning, and that was just never our interest. I mean, the film, I think, is critical in a lot of ways, but it's even-handed and it's very loving. But I think the real test of how it may or may not be accepted in that community and what long-term ramifications for us and for our cast is still yet to be determined as this thing becomes more available to the public in the States.
And was that something that kind of stopped, say, Lustig, for example, like taking on this role? Because, you know, being in a movie like this can actually, I've heard it can mean like sort of banishment from the community.
Yeah.
And like, how do you kind of overcome something like that? Does it mean...
I think everybody was, all of our cast members had a lot of trepidation about doing the movie, and at various points throughout making it were like, oh man, maybe I shouldn't stay with this. And there was always the fear for Josh and I, particularly when we were shooting this thing on and off for a year and a half, like, what if one day Menasha or somebody else just wakes up and is like, I can't do this anymore. And then we've shot half a movie and can't get them to come back. Fortunately, that never happened. We lost one key actor about a week before we were going to start filming, and that created a lot of chaos in terms of recasting that role, but it all worked out in the end. But I think for all of them, they felt like whatever risks that they might be taking in terms of backlash in their community was worth it to them because they wanted to tell their stories. And thus far, they're all still in that world. You know, again, it's. I think over the next few months we'll get a better sense to see what the reaction really is going to be.
One of the hardest things for probably from a producing point is working with kids, and especially a young kid over a potentially a year of time. How do you kind of navigate like shooting something like that where, you know, you've got a young kid and then hopefully not by the end of it you've maybe got facial hair or a big Adam's apple?
We try. So Ruben, who plays Reuben in the film, we tried to shoot most of his stuff in the very first section of the shoot. So 80% of his performance was shot in that first week, and he was about 6.5 or 7 at that point. And then about a year later, we brought him back for a few more days to do some additional scenes and reshoot a few scenes. And, like, he grew a few inches. Like, if you look really closely, his age fluctuates throughout the movie, but thus far, not a single person has ever commented on it. I mean, you have to, like, really be paying attention.
That'll be something to keep an eye on when Netflix comes
in. But, I mean, like, the trick with working with child actors, especially non-professional ones, it always comes down to the same thing, which is bribes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you bribe them with candy, you bribe them with fun, you know, they'll do a scene, like, twice, And then they'll be like, okay. And you'll be like, okay, we're going to move the cameras over here. And they're like, no, we just did this. I don't want to do this again. It's like, oh, God. But like, we've got some skills for you, like, if you can keep going.
Great, right?
And, you know, they're getting paid, but it's like, they don't care about the money. So it's just about short-term goals and finding ways to kind of, like, play around with them and have fun in between takes to kind of keep their energy up.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, he Ruben's a really sweet kid, and I think was pretty game to be in the movie, and I think he came and saw it in Berlin during the festival then, and I think it was a totally surreal experience for him. I mean, we went up on stage, and there were probably 600-700 people in that audience, all Germans, and he just kind of looked over at me and was like, there are a lot of people here. I think, like, it was finally dawning on him at that moment that, like, this wasn't just this fun little thing that he was making with, like, a handful of, like, weird adults. That it was something that was going to be seen in a much wider way in the world.
And what has been the kind of the reaction from kind of the stars and yourself? So as you go on the kind of the festival circuit, now you're here in Edinburgh to the movie, have you been impressed by the response? Has it been what you've expected?
Yeah, I mean, the film has been really overwhelmingly positively received, which has been, you know, a real honor and also an enormous relief. I think for Menashe, he was always sort of like, why is anybody going to want to watch this movie? Who's actually going to care about me? And that was part of his concern. And the other concern was that he's seen very, very few movies in his lifetime. I mean, maybe less than a dozen. Mm-hmm. And he'd never been in a movie theater prior to our premiere at Sundance. And so I think his understanding of movies and of acting and things like that was this notion of, like, okay, here's a scene. Like, you walk in a room and you sit down on a bed and you pray. Mm-hmm. For him, it's like, this isn't interesting. Like, where's all the drama? Where's all the full humor? Where's all the big emotions? And so there's, I think for him, when we were shooting it, he was sort of constantly like, who is going to care about this? There's nothing happening. And then when he actually sat down and watched the film with an audience in Park City for Sundance, it clicked for him. And, you know, he saw people weeping and clapping when it was all over. And I think he understood, I think, the enormity of all of these people from all over the world and all walks of life connecting with his story in some way. And it was, I think, an enormously emotional experience for him at Sundance, that first screening. It was the unveiling of this movie that's based off his life that he stars in every frame. It was also his first time in a movie theater watching a movie.
It sounds like a documentary in itself.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I wish we had cameras filming him throughout that process. I think there's footage of the Q&A itself, but yeah, none of us even realized it until the night before that he'd never been in a theater before.
Yeah.
The night before, we were talking with the head of programming at Sundance, and he was like, oh, Menashe, are you excited to see your movie tomorrow? And I was just like, wait a minute, Menashe, have you ever been to a movie theater before?
Yeah.
And he was like, no. Oh my God.
It must be a challenge as a producer to working on a set where, you know, usually you've got kind of seasoned actors and professionals that, okay, I need you here, and this is bit of technology. How do you go through, like, a process where you explain and write, kind of building something where you go, like, this is everything that you need to know, and giving them all that information that you get secondhand.
I think they're definitely, it's a really different tool set for a director when you're working with non-professional actors than it is with professional actors. Professional actors, you can give them pretty tight blocking. You can dig into character psychology in a pretty deep way. They take direction. It can be very flexible. You know, they're seasoned pros. They rehearse. With non-professional actors, I think a lot of the success of getting that to work is about keeping a sense of spontaneity and forcing them really to be interacting with each other. So what I learned from Andrew Pajalski, who had been directed the first film I produced, and you know, has been making great films for 10 years now, mostly with non-professional actors, was he never showed them the scripts. He never gave them line readings. There was very little rehearsal. It was really just about giving people the right kind of context for the scene and then just working your way through it slowly and letting them kind of organically feel it out and giving them more time on average to shoot each scene than you would with pros. And so we took a similar approach with this film, and particularly by virtue of the fact that there was a fair bit of improvisation there. We hadn't rehearsed, so everyone was kind of figuring it out. Nobody had seen scripts, so they didn't, like, know their lines. And the fact that the movie's in a foreign language that neither Josh nor I speak, everything moves really slowly. So every scene probably took three times as long to shoot as it would with English language pro actors. But I think it gives things a way to really organically evolve in a nice way over that time. And for not only the actors to kind of figure out the scene, but for Josh and I to kind of figure out each scene as well. And a lot of them changed quite significantly during the shooting process, just in terms of what we were getting from the actors.
It sounds like amazing that after all those hurdles that you had to overcome, that you've produced this amazing movie, and you know, well done on another
thank
section.
Thank you. I mean, it's certainly like there's an alternate version of this movie that's just an unwatchable disaster. I think the key for us was always trying to keep things as authentic as possible and just moving really slowly but surely throughout the process of making it, rather than kind of rushing headlong into being like, all right, we're going to shoot this in a month, and once this train leaves the station, like, there's no stopping it. I think it's more like the process of creating other art. Like, you know, you don't give a painter like a few weeks to paint a painting.
Absolutely.
They take their time. A composer takes their time to compose, and it was a similar process that I think is quite different than how most films are made.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, and
thank you.
Best with your festival run, and
cheers.
Yeah, you've made an amazing movie. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
And we're back, and it's now time to find out what you guys made of the film. So was Menashe a case of mazel tov or a mazel turn off? And apologies for the joke.
I think for me, I suppose, like, I had no expectation of kind of checking out this film when the film festival in 2017 was the first one I'd ever gone to. And I don't know, it might be the same for Laura, that we're sort of kind of been getting into this game and biz for a little while now. But when you sort of get like the opportunity where like someone, like usually you're spending your time emailing people to say, hey, I really want to promote your work, I love what you do, please let me in the hotel suite for you for 15 minutes so I can sit opposite you and interview. And a lot of time you don't hear anything, or maybe you get offered the opportunities that you're like, oh, okay, it wasn't what I hoped for, but sure, I'll come along. And I remember this was like an early email that I'd received from, I think I'd done an interview for something, which I was kind of just like happy to have done one. And they reached out to me and went, would you be interested in interviewing the co-writer and co-producer of this film, Menashe? And I was like, I kind of read it and I saw like it just sounded okay. It wasn't really what I was kind of hoping to do. But I was like, you know what? I'll get an opportunity to interview someone else. It's something else that we can add to the portfolio. Yep, count me in. I remember going along to see the film and being so surprised when I caught it at the festival. It was one of these ones that I can't believe I almost passed on it or hadn't thought about, considered checking it out. I mean, this is A24's first film that's not in the English language. And I love films about pathetic losers that sort of struggle to get by. And I just thought this was such an interesting combination of drama sort of through a lens of almost a documentary style. I mean, you think of how huge the Yiddish language used to be, that you had tens of millions of people speaking it, especially fluently, and now that number is just an absolute fraction. And you have this, you know, I think we've all been to New York, obviously you have, Dallas, you know, you've written a bloody book about film locations in New York, but sort of the Hasidic community in New York is, you're aware of it as being this sort of place, but it's not really a place for, you know, it's not part of the tourist community, but you're aware of these Hasidic Jews on the public transport, sometimes doing some selling on the sidewalk, and it always seems a little bit alien. And I thought this film was such a great way to get into that community. And I thought Menashe, you know, this first time actor who'd never even seen a film in his life, was such a great way to view this community and how it all works and the challenges that people go through. The idea that, you know, people are forced to remarry as soon as someone's passed away as a partner. It's just a really interesting kind of society. And, you know, it's very rare that with A24 films, and I don't mean this in a negative way, sort of expose you to a completely different culture where you come away going, you know what, I really learned something today. I understand this community a little bit better. I think Menashe does that, and I think it does it in such an effective way. I was really passionate about this one.
Yeah, so Laura, when did you first hear about this film and when did you first see it?
I literally heard about it when Lee invited me on the podcast. It absolutely was not on my radar. I'd never even heard of it. And to be honest, if I'd just like seen the synopsis by accident, I probably wouldn't have checked it out. But I ended up quite much like enjoying it. And same as Lee, I didn't really know much about that community before. And it was really interesting to sort of get a small glimpse into the workings of it, the sort of relationships happening and And to hear the language spoken, I thought was really interesting, especially when you got the subtitles on and you can compare which sort of words overlap with the English and stuff.
Yeah, no, it was a huge surprise for me as well, because it was one that wasn't on my radar as well, and like, you probably wouldn't have watched it if it wasn't for this podcast. And then, so there I am, I'm about to watch it early morning in a unnamed coffee shop, because, you know, we don't want to promote one over the other, you know, other coffee shops are available. But I put it on and then realised, oh right, oh, there's some subtitles, and then I went, oh right, the entire thing is in Yiddish, okay. So stopped, because I knew I would be distracted, and basically I had to watch it at home one evening when I knew that I'd be able to, because I have to watch subtitle movies without any other sort of distraction, because I just find it easier to sort of immerse myself in the world. And it was really interesting to sort of to hear this language. And, you know, you've got the, you know, A24, the diversity factor is in play again here. You know, I think we talked a couple of episodes ago on the project about how they don't seem to have like a cookie cutter one shape fits all for their audiences. They try different things to find new markets and audiences. You know, Moonlight was clearly targeting the LGBT and African-American audiences. This one is a very specific audience, and then you've got it as well. There's probably comparisons you could make with The Farewell, which is just out, another A24 film, which is probably like sort of at least half, two-thirds of it is in Mandarin as well, and also offering a sort of a different slice of life and a different view on a different world and customs and the way that these sort of families operate. So I found that a really sort of interesting sort of mix in way to approach it. And like you say, there's almost sort of documentary style filmmaking where initially it feels like it's just following this character, but you know, then it does sort of develop this sort of narrative story about how if he's going to sort of re-immerse himself into sort of trying to find a wife in order to get this family back. So I mean, so I'm pretty sure you both guys have sort of said that in terms of your knowledge of the sort of Hasidic community, it was probably sort of very enlightened by watching this film, was it?
I personally feel so, yeah. Like, you know, you're aware of some of the stereotypes, like how the people dress and their language. And I just thought it was a really interesting insight into sort of their religion and their kind of cultures, especially around marriage. And, you know, especially sort of the unique perspective of, you know, you know, a divorce, you know, a separate, a bereaved husband, and what's it like to, you know, how that kind of works in that relationship. And, you know, it feels sort of horrible that what this character kind of has to go through, that his son, you know, is almost continually taken away from him. He's looked down upon as a father figure, and that he must find someone else to be able to almost have this stable relationship with his kid. You know, you almost didn't get that time to breathe and, you know, have a life beyond, you know, grieve, really. I just think that was quite shocking, really. And it almost reminded me of another film quite recently where Apostasy, it was a UK film all about the Jehovah's Witnesses. And again, it's some people that you maybe see on the street, you have the most basic idea of their religion, but then a film like that, you know, told by people from within it, really opens it up, and it gives you a real insight into sort of that mysterious community. I thought it was a great way to sort of see the positives of the community, but also some of the negatives of those that are religiously follow it.
Absolutely. And Laura, did you was this sort of an insight into the Yiddish and Hasidic Jew community for you as well?
Well, I feel like it's not a documentary about the religion or about the community. It's more, it fits around a quite universal story of the relationship between a father and son with sort of the context of the religion. So it doesn't feel like it's all exposition, for instance. It feels more like normalized, which I particularly liked, because it's so far from what we are exposed to, particularly in Britain, where there's not much of that community, that it'd be very easy to just put them under a microscope and examine everything. But it comes along very naturally, and it doesn't feel like you're being shown something behind closed doors. It feels much more welcoming.
Yeah, no, I thought it felt really sort of balanced in it in its storytelling. It didn't sort of come down particularly on sort of one side of this potential argument about whether or not he should, you know, be basically force himself to get remarried in order to win his son back, because he does do a lot to try and sort of improve his situation. But you know, he's almost got this sort of John Candy sort of sad sack sort of thing, that everything he tries to do sort of backfires on him. So you've got this sort of, you're sort of really sort of wanting him to turn his life around in order to, because there's such a even though they've only got a sort of few scenes together, because the son keeps getting taken back to the other family, his sort of brother-in-law's family. They really have a sort of nice chemistry in it, and so it brings us on to the sort of the lead performance of, and sort of like you said, this is his first and only real sort of acting sort of gig. What did you guys think of Menashe's performance in this? Laura, let's come to you first.
I thought it was completely credible, and I don't know if that's anything to do with his acting talent, because I know a lot of it is loosely based on his experience, and that he is the guy really is a grocer and a widower, and I think that just works well with the sort of more authentic vibe of the film. But so I think it worked well. Like, as far as I'm aware, no one on that film was actual like actors. They were all sort of first timers selected strictly for the film because they fit with the story, which is an interesting sort of directing choice.
For me, I really loved him in this thing, and as Laura says, like, it's drawn from his life. And what I find quite interesting is that he is sort of this Hasidic Jew comedian, and I think that you can tell that as well, that there's so many times where you sort of see him going about his daily life in the shop when, you know, he just seems so bedraggled and, you know, put through the ringer. And there's something about his face and how he handles it that immediately pulls you in. You have sort of sympathy for him. But at points as well, you're sort of amused by some of the shenanigans he gets himself into. I mean, even things like the, you know, he's in such a rush that, and then all this fish completely falls out all over the kind of road as well. And you almost can just imagine him. It almost is that sort of little cartoon vibe of like, oh, what an idiot, dough kind of thing. And I just think that he does that so well. I think in the wrong hands, performance like this could be a caricature, but you know, Menashe Lustig seems to be playing what he does best. And it's fascinating to see a performance like this from a first time actor, let alone someone that had never really seen a film before.
No, I think you're absolutely right on that, because especially in sort of drawing on to what Laura was saying about basically having an entire cast of sort of first time actors, it's almost incredible and baffling to think that, you know, this film got made, because you can imagine that, you know, a lot of them probably were quite wary about, you know, exposing themselves and their sort of community and their beliefs and traditions into sort of like a big screen story. So it's all credit to the filmmakers, the writers and director here, who've managed to get them on board in order to tell and basically show a slice of life in this from this community, and crafting a really sort of beautiful and sort of heartwarming story. Again, like you say, Laura, which is ultimately boils down to the sort of universal sort of love of a father for his son and wanting to be the best father that he can be. So does anyone have any sort of final thoughts on Menashe before we move on?
I think you made a great point. I think this makes a great double bill with the Farewell. I think when I watched that film the other day, you know, it's a film that's nearly all in Chinese language, and something like Menashe as well, I think it's so great to have, you know, people from within that sort of community, Joshua Weinstein, Menashe Lustig, and then sort of Lulu Wang, kind of get the opportunity to tell these stories from a really unique point of view, and one that, you know, we think of a lot of the traditional A24 films, a lot of them are told about white people and white middle class woes and so on, you know, from, you know, obviously there's exceptions to that, and I think these two films certainly do stand out in sort of the representation and giving voices to perhaps filmmakers that haven't, you know, might struggle to get opportunities with some of the larger organizations. So I think this one's a really good film to watch, and I would definitely recommend a double bill with the Farewell.
Yeah, or maybe even a double bill of this in Uncut Gems, looking at Jewish people in New York perhaps.
Yeah, most definitely.
Cool. So I guess it's time. It's the big one. And as a band which I can't remember the name of once said, you don't have to take your clothes off to have a good time. Oh no, that's right. Arpat stands, assemble. It's time to discuss Good Time. Good Time is written and directed by the Safdie brothers, which features, after a bank robbery, sees his younger brother go to prison, Connie Nikas embarks on a twisted odyssey through the New York City's underworld in order to get his brother out of jail. This was the film that certainly for Lee and I cemented Arpat's credentials, as featured on a filibuster episode where we stand Arpat's, which is available to download and listen to now, after you finish this one, of course. But, you know, he's not always had his fans, it would be fair to say. Now, I teased this on an earlier episode, but I want to tell Lee an anecdote about Jack Whitehall. Now, as far as I'm aware, Lee, you're not really a Jack Whitehall fan, are you?
Absolutely not.
No. Well, Laura, are you a Jack Whitehall fan?
He's all right.
He's all right. But
nothing more than
nothing
that.
Nothing more than that. No, but I was watching one of his stand-ups because it was on Netflix, Jack Whitehall at Large, available to watch on Netflix now if you want to see the full story. And he's talking about this. He's doing a stand-up routine about how he went to school and loved doing drama. But unfortunately, he was in the same year and class as a certain Robert Pattinson at school. And Robert Pattinson would always get the lead role while Jack was Villager 17. Now, he was very bitter about this for years and did stand-up routines about how terrible Arpat was as an actor and slagging off the Twilight films, which, you know, is fair enough because, you know, they're not very good films. But then, a few years later, Jack is forced to eat his words because he has the opportunity to audition for a film to be the co-lead against Robert Pattinson. And his agent sends him an email with the description of the character, and he gets to be the co-lead because he would be the brother of Robert Pattinson, but he has to play the, as in quotes in the email, the mentally handicapped brother of Robert Pattinson. Now, no one in the audience seems to, you know, bat an eyelid at this, but for me, I'm immediately recognising that this can only be one particular film that he would be auditioning for, because I think there's only one film where Robert Pattinson has had a mentally handicapped, or as Jack Whitehall completely accurately puts out, a brother with learning difficulties. And it must, so at one point, Jack Whitehall must have auditioned for the role of Robert Pattinson's brother in Good Time. Now, can you two imagine a world where we would be discussing and rating so highly Good Time if it featured Jack Whitehall as Robert Pattinson's mentally handicapped brother?
I'm so fucking shocked right now. I never knew this. Like, I'm just sitting there like, you're saying that, and in like my head I'm just hearing like you talking, and not that I doubt it, I'm like thinking like, fuck off, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's bizarre. Like, the fact that he was even sent it, like someone knew him, saw the script and was like, you know, he'd be a good fit for this.
Maybe they just his Bad Education TV series and went, oh, he looks mentally handicapped, maybe he'll be a good fit for it.
Oh no.
But of course, the outcome of this is he didn't get the part, and clearly, no actor was good enough, so it ended up that one of the Safdie brothers himself had to step in and play the role. So imagine that, the director's sitting there watching you do your audition and go, I could do better than that. Actually, I think I will. So yeah, so that's where it leaves us, because of course, Benny Safdie ends up playing the role of the brother against Robert Pattinson. But Laura, let's come to you first. When did you first hear about, and when did you first see Good Time, and did you have the proverbial good time watching it?
I first saw it actually quite recently, like a couple months ago. It's a weird one that I've always been meaning to watch and never was quite in the right mood for. But yeah, absolutely loved it. Like, such a revelation. Like, I knew obviously Robert Pattinson was like a good actor, but I think that was the first time where I was like truly blown away, to the point where you kind of forget you're watching him. He just becomes the character, which is always like an achievement for stars that were associated with such a specific role, in his case, Edward Cullen in Twilight. But yeah, absolutely fantastic movie. And to be honest, the Safdie brother who plays R. Patz's brother, like, does such a good job. He should do more acting, like, honestly.
Yeah, no, I think it's... Yeah, he's excellent. And yeah, this was the one that really sort of cemented R. Patz's status. Although there were glimpses earlier, and actually looking back at the Twilight films, I'm not sure if anyone's seen the clip on Twitter going around of what sounds like a drunk Robert Pattinson with Kristen Stewart in the pod booth doing the audio commentary for Eclipse, where he basically tears the film a new one about how awful it is while watching it. So I highly recommend it. It's almost enough to make me rent Eclipse to get the audio commentary to listen to the whole thing. I think it'd be fantastic. So Lee, when did you first see Good Time?
Yeah, I saw this one a couple years ago. I think it had the poorest of rollouts here in the UK cinemas. I don't recall it even sort of coming to Edinburgh, which is shocking. So I think it had quite a quick release in the UK. I think it was Artificial sort of Curzon had released it. So the Blu-ray was on sort of out quite quickly. I picked it up sort of at the tail end of the year because it was one of these films before I sort of solidified my top 10 for that year. I really wanted to see this one, and I sort of didn't know much kind of going into it apart from this buzz, and I really liked it straight away. I mean, it's just this, I'd seen the Safdie brothers' previous film, I think, what's it called, Heaven Can Wait, Heaven Knows What. And I was immediately sort of looking forward to seeing what they did next with Good Time. And sort of I'd heard this good buzz. I was enjoying Robert Pattinson's indie work. You know, he continued to star in some really interesting A24 films. And I just loved this one. It was just that one day, absolutely intense film where everything that could go wrong does go wrong. And it's one of those ones that just feels like you're watching it, like Jaws, for example. There's so many moments you think, okay, you know, things are pretty bad now, but if you just go do this or just step aside here, things will get less bad. And everything just continues to get worse and worse for all the characters involved. And I just thought it's the type of film I really like, where it's just that non-stop intensity where you almost feel like you're going to have a panic attack or anxiety, that you're screaming at these characters to, you know, step away, stop what they're doing. And, you know, Constantine character, he makes so many terrible decisions, often perhaps for the right reason. You know, he comes from a good place, but he really is an absolute idiot. And you know, my heart breaks for Nicholas. You know, I think I've the type of work I do, I work in mental health and such like, and I recognize and see characters like Nicholas, and you know, you hear about people taking advantage of them and so on, and there's definitely an element of that within this relationship, but there is a lot of love too. And I think that complexity makes this such an interesting dynamic between the two brothers.
Yeah, no, I mean, like you say, he's doing bad things for the right reason. Although he doesn't start off that way, because, you know, he's using his brother to do a robbery, hold up a bank, and then it's only when his brother then gets in jail. But his heart does sort of come from a good place where he just wants to get him out. But it just, like you say, sets off this almost like unbelievable chain of events where things just continually go from bad to worse. I know, for example, finding out that his brother's in hospital, so he goes to find his brother, breaks his brother out of the hospital, only to then find out a little bit later that he's got the entirely wrong guy and then has to go back with him. And it's just like, you're just going, oh, you're shaking your head, but he's got, like you say, he's got enough sort of charisma, and because of like the good heart that he has, it seems you're willing him on to try and, you know, achieve his goals, even though they're not, it's not always coming from the right place. So, I mean, yeah, Laura, what did you think of the character's motivations, and were you willing him on his incredible journey into the night?
Well, I think you see him take advantage of a lot of people, of a lot of the different characters that actually extend a helping hand to him, and that's sort of, it is hard to watch because you want to like him, but you also have to understand that where he comes from, he doesn't necessarily feel any obligation to be kind to others or to be considerate, because he's clearly been brought up to have to care for himself and for his brother, and for those to be the priorities, without really any regard for outsiders. And it's hard to watch, you know, especially with the woman who opens up his home to him, and him taking advantage of the young granddaughter. But at the same time, you're kind of torn knowing that he's not doing it strictly to be malicious. It's just how he is. So you do end up sort of rooting for him and hoping he doesn't get caught.
Yeah, and so the Safdie brothers sort of take him on one hell of a ride, sort of from place to place, and it's all sort of powered through by this sort of pounding sort of soundtrack and amazing sort of visuals and stuff like that. And I read that Robert Pattinson had basically written to the directors after seeing a still image on the internet of their first film, Heaven Knows What, and had basically written to them and saying, I want to make a film with you guys, let's put something together. And then they started writing this film for him. And I think similar to what you were saying, Laura, about how he sort of almost sort of disappears into the role. Apparently he lived in New York in like a tiny sort of flat and just wandered around perfecting the Brooklyn accent, trying to sort of blend in. Apparently sort of even going to sort of grocery store and someone said, hey, do you know that you look like Robert Pattinson? Are you Robert Pattinson? He says, oh yeah, no, I get that a lot and stuff like that. So, and at that point, the filmmakers knew that they could basically, you know, shoot this almost sort of guerrilla style around New York and people weren't going to bother them. So you wouldn't have had screaming twihards running after them because nobody seemed to recognize sort of Robert Pattinson in the thing. So Lee, what did you make of the Safdie brothers' filmmaking style in terms of sort of the visuals and their use of music in the film?
Yeah, I think it's one of those ones. It's like the ultimate kind of neon trip into this hell that this character is bringing upon himself and those around him, that, you know, no matter what room they go into, whether it's the bail bonds, whether it's these people's house, you know, even sort of when they break into the security guard's house at the end, the theme park, everything is just so bright. Everything is just that. You can almost, I know it's, I always kind of think of when, you know, you're tired, you've been on a night out or something, like you maybe had a bit to drink, and just like when you have that intensity of light and over visual stimulus, and it just sort of still keeps you going, but it kind of mildly annoys you, and it almost gives you that motivation why someone like this Robert Pattinson's character continues to manage to stay up all night. And you just feel like the music, the production design, it gets that sort of drug injection right into you as well. I just think even things like, you know, when they go to the theme park and it's all dark, you just know eventually someone's going to go, right, hit the light on this theme park, and it just brings it all to life. I just think it's, the score is so good, the visual design, it's one of these films that so many films, whether some of the maybe smaller indie films that we've maybe kind of done on the A24 project, some of the perhaps more direct TV ones, you know, you look at the film and you think, oh yeah, that's a director that's kind of for hire, it's kind of point and shoot, whereas this you go, oh wow, like this kind of connects really well with Heaven Knows What, and it's like it feels like it's part of that shared universe, that shared style, and it probably explains why the Safdie brothers have continued to build up this, you know, much hyped and people being interested in their work, because they know they're going to get something unique and original from a sound and visual level as well as engrossing characters. So it's, you get the whole package with them.
Absolutely. So Laura, were you sort of drawn into this adventure by their use of sort of camera work and music?
Yeah, I definitely thought that the music was absolutely incredible and really sort of helps keep up the pace and the energy of the film throughout. But what I found most interesting was the camera work and the use of light. I thought really contributed to the sort of frantic pace and mood of the film, which kind of throws you into the main character's mindset at the same time and helps you keep going along with him. And I think you get into this sort of altered state where, you know, you don't really know what time it's meant to be, everything's really bright and very stylish but loud and overbearing, and I think that sort of shuts out the world outside you, and you sort of really delve into the story and into Connie's mindset and into you his vision of the world in a way that's really, really interesting and very impactful.
Yeah, no, because I mean, New York is famously the city that never sleeps, and certainly with the music and the cinematography, it doesn't allow the audience to sleep either. Even though, you know, this film is only sort of an hour and 40 minutes, the pace of it is just so intense that it's you're almost sort of bombarded visually and audibly, that you just have to pay attention to what's going on. And the cinematographer is Sean Price Williams, and I know Leo will be excited to know that he was also the cinematographer on, I think, your favourite film of the year so far, Her Smell. Did you notice any similarities on that one?
Yeah, I don't know if you guys have seen Her Smell. I think it's still, as it stands at this point of the year, it's my favourite film. And the two of them seem to have this sort of connection of, they're both based in New York and in and around New York. And it's these sort of films where it's just, it is an intensity. It's that buzz, it's that adrenaline of drugs, of, you know, terrible behaviour. And I think he captures that really well, that, I know sort of Alex Ross Perry had spoken about how, you know, they pretty much filmed the entire film on Steadicam, and that they wanted him involved in sort of shooting this film, that he has developed this reputation, sort of what you see with films like Good Time, of being able to do really incredible things with cameras. And I think that's reflected in this is like a hell of a calling card for, you know, the Safdie brothers had, you know, a good reputation amongst film fans before this film, but based on Good Time, even for our Pats, you know, everyone has come out of this film with their reputations kind of high to the moon. And I think, you know, you look at the buzz for Uncut Gems when the trailer dropped today, you know, they were even able to hype up that, oh my god, in like 48 hours the Uncut Gems trailer is going to drop. And I think that's all testament to the kind of quality of something like Good Time, and how many people have continued to find this film. It's a film that I think very few saw in the cinema, but most people are finding now on Netflix and word of mouth, whether it's mates recommending it to people or folk going, hey, you know, give Robert Pattinson a chance, you know, for Batman, check out this film Good Time. It seems to be shorthand for, trust us, Robert Pattinson's a good actor and here's how.
Yeah, I know Matt Reeves basically posted an image from Good Time to basically justify his choice of why he picked Robert Pattinson. And I want to point out that I actually saw Good Time in a cinema. The Belmont programmed it, so I was able to see it on the big screen, although I then did the rewatch while on a treadmill watching it on Netflix, and I think I actually ran that 10k faster than any other 10k on the treadmill. I think I was just my adrenaline was up, and it was helped by the soundtrack, of course, which was by Daniel Lopatin, who also did the Bling Ring soundtrack, which is a convenient way of plugging the fact that we're going to have a interview coming up with Katie Chang from the Bling Ring, and you'll both be glad to hear that he is doing the soundtrack for Uncut Gems. I love the soundtrack on the trailer of it, so it's good that he's going to be coming back. But I mean, I love sort of, obviously I love films in New York, like you say, I wrote the book on it, and I'm really like films, especially like Martin Scorsese's After Hours, where you see, you know, the sort of dirtier, grittier side of New York. And this After Hours is a very similar one, about a guy who goes on a night out and ends up getting involved in this incredible adventure against his will. And this is what this film feels like. But I think it shows the Safdie brothers are filmmakers to be reckoned with. And it's really exciting to see what they're going to have sort of coming up after Uncut Gems. I think the world's their oyster. You know, they'll probably get offered a franchise at some point. But of course, knowing us and this project and how it works with news, as soon as this episode drops, we'll find out that they have been, and we'll be behind the times again. So, guys, in terms of sort of rankings and where you would place Good Time, Lee, I think I know where you're going to put this one, but Laura, where does Good Time rank for you in terms of A24's output and the ones that you've seen so far?
It's definitely in the top five. I don't know if it was my absolute favourite, just because there's so many incredible standouts that maybe I relate to more, but like stylishly and as a good time, it really does it for me. So yeah, defo top five. I'm not sure exactly where in the top five, but it's up there.
Excellent. And Lee, top five as well for you?
just out of it. So, obviously, me and you rank as we go through these films that I know I have, I think you do. We have like a letterbox list where after the end of an episode has been recorded, I place that film in a ranking. So, yeah. My top five at the moment is Under the Skin at 1, Ghost Story at 2, Moonlight 3, American Honey 4, 20th Century Woman 5, and Good Time at 6. So it's placed 6 out of 54. And I love that film. Like, it's a 4.5 out of 5 film for me. I really do think it's a great film. But the others have just sort of, you know, Good Time is something I've only just recently revisited for the second time. I still really enjoyed it. I thought it was an incredible rewatch. But the other ones I've kind of sat with for a bit longer, you know, I've loved them. And I think, you know, Good Time couldn't go what could go higher up in the list. But just like some of the others, they just need to just sort of settle for a little while.
Absolutely. But I mean, for me, Good Time is, well, I'm going to put it up once we finish this episode onto my letterbox. But I would say it's at my number 4 at the moment behind Under the Skin, Ghost Story, Moonlight. And then it'd be Good Time for me, I think, because I had a great time watching this one. And I would happily watch it again. So does anyone have any sort of final thoughts, Jerry Springer-style final thoughts on Good Time and its position in A24?
What I love, and this is a spoiler moment, really. So if you haven't seen the film...
We got all the way through, nearly through the episode without spoilers.
I know, I feel I need to say it, though. So,
but you're talking about the fact that people haven't really seen this film, and then you're going to go and spoil it for them.
Exactly. Well, if you've made it to this 50-43... Oh, wait a second. We're nearly an hour long with the interview thrown in. So if you made it to this point, go check out the film, then come back. You know, put a wee pause
on the podcast, come back, Spoiler what I would say is, go ahead.
What I love about this film and why I think... elevates it so much, and it really struck me sort of on my rewatch is ultimately how pointless the whole kind of event is. And I think that's what makes it so great, is that if Connie had just left things as it were, if he had left Nicholas in, you know, the support network they had at the beginning, where, you know, he was being exposed to things, he was getting the right care, you know, things would have worked out, would have just kind of continued on for Nicholas, like where he ends up at the end, where he goes, joins this therapy class, and they're doing the group activity, and he's sort of in a happy place, he seems settled, and then you see that Constantine has taken him out of it, and he has gone to all this hassle to have a failed bank robbery, that everything's escalated, he's had to, you know, drag a young kid into this, he's managed to get a pure security guard drugged, breaked into a place, someone's fallen to their death that would have just stayed in hospital and probably had a small prison sentence for, you know, shenanigans. And then, obviously, Constantine ends up in jail at the end. And Connie, the final shots just end up with him in this therapy class that he probably would have been in if Constantine hadn't have come in. So it just feels like the whole thing was the biggest waste of time, and all the death, the failed robbery attempts, they made no money, it was just an absolute disaster. And I love that about the film, that it was just like, it wasn't even sort of like the end where you get to and go, oh, they kind of lived happily ever after. Like, basically Connie has just delayed the inevitable of his brother getting the kind of good support that he wanted to, and it was just the biggest waste of time. And I love that about the film. I think that makes it particularly special in my eyes.
I want to know what sort of prison sentence, what length of prison sentence do you get for shenanigans exactly? Is that a couple of years, a couple of months, time off for good behaviour? I want to know. But, I mean, what you've put up there is...
Yeah, I don't know, actually.
What you brought up there is, if you want to talk about pointless films, you know, I have seen arguments that Raiders of the Lost Ark is one of the most pointless films, and that Indiana Jones basically goes, finds the Ark first, and then Nazis get the Ark back, and essentially, you know, if he just left them to it, they would have found the Ark, taken it to the island, and would have all died anyway. So basically, you know, he was just delaying the inevitable as well. So I guess, yeah, this is a perfect double bill then for delaying the inevitable, Raiders of the Lost Ark in the Good Time. Is that a double bill you'd watch, Laura?
Definitely not one I would have come up with on my own, but... after that hot take, I might need to put them back to back.
Yeah. So, Laura, have you got any sort of final thoughts on the Good Time that you had with Good Time?
just that it's really enjoyable, and you know, it's a wee shame that I actually don't know that many people outside of the sort of film buff community who've seen it. And I'm definitely hoping that now that RPATS is moving into the sort of much more mainstream time with like Batman, but as a serious actor, maybe that's going to start shining more of a light on his past indie contributions and get this one, get people to watch this one. Plus it's on Netflix, so like, what you got to lose?
Exactly. It's only an hour and 40 minutes as well, but I mean, I think this is probably the best one for to try and convince people of his talent in terms of his A24 projects, because you know, you've got The Rover and then Good Time, and then it just gets a little bit weirder gradually as you go in, because then you're into High Life and then you're into The Lighthouse, which for all accounts is completely bonkers. So at the moment he is A24's most high profile and most consistent actor. That's four films he's done now for A24, so he's A24's leading man, and hopefully it'll continue if he manages to get every other summer off to do an one for them and one for him. He can do an A24 film whenever he's not doing a Batman sequel and stuff like that. So so long may it continue, the reign of RPATS. But that brings us to the end of this episode. Hopefully you will join us in a couple of weeks when we're going to have reviewing Woodshock and The Florida Project, which is of course one of the inspirations for this name. And then in a couple of weeks after that, we're building up to the big Lady Bird episode, one of our most popular films and one that introduced a lot of people like yourself, Laura, into the A24 fold. So if you play your cards right and keep Lee sweet, there's potentially, I guess, we might see you back in the pod booth for that one.
I'll be spending lots of money bribing.
Well, you need to do is buy us an A24 candle, like, and that's gets you on the show.
Or a mug.
Oh, that's the dream, though. They're so cool. I'd spend so much time on the online shop and then being like, oh wait, I have no money. But anyway,
like, imagine spending $45 on a candle. You know, I have an interview coming up in a few weeks with Chrisia Fairchild, where her name is basically the title of the movie, and they gave her like a freak mug. And she was like, oh yeah, I know the person from the shop on the interview. And I was like, you know, want to put in a word for us and send us some $45 candles, because I want to know what the smell of sci-fi is.
Well, if it's anything like High Life, I can tell you exactly what the smell's going to be. And it's not pleasant.
I would like to ask a small question of Laura as well. So obviously me and you, Dallas, are fans of The Souvenir. The Souvenir Part 2 was going to star RPATS. I know you weren't keen on The Souvenir, but would you have kind of considered rewatching The Souvenir? Would you have gone to see the second Souvenir film for RPATS, or did the film leave such a bad impression on you that you would not kind of check it out?
I would definitely have checked it out if RPATS was in it. Like, I really didn't enjoy the film. Like, I'm sorry to say, and I know that's most people like really really enjoyed it, and I wish I'd gotten the same thing out of it that they did. I probably now wouldn't go see the sequel, but had RPATS been in it, I have total faith in his projects. So yeah, you would have seen me at the cinema.
Excellent. I was just curious. So obviously he's not going to be in the one. Will you see The Souvenir Part 2 without him in it?
Probably.
No. I was just curious.
Well, only if it's on a double bill with another film that you want to talk about in a future episode of the A24 Project.
That's right.
If it coincides with the next Greta Gerwig film, then perhaps. Excellent. Well, Laura, it's been a pleasure having you on and talking to you about these films, and hopefully we'll see you back in a future episode, but we'll see everyone else back in a couple of weeks for the next time that we discuss the A24 Project. Until then, bye-bye. Cheers.